This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. The First Time podcast has a newsletter. It will go out monthly-ish. To sign up, go to our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com, and click on the Sign Up to Our Newsletter link.
So, Catherine.
Yes, Kate.
A little while back, we put a call out for questions from our listeners, and we have got some. We've chosen to answer three today. We're actually going to do this anonymously.
Yeah, I think it's better.
Yeah. So we will attempt to wow you with all of our incredible expertise, but please know, is it like when accountants do it or like when financial people give advice but say,
oh, yes,
like
we're not
disclaimer.
Doctors. We're
yeah,
not.
Yeah. You know, there's other ways that you can find out information to these questions, but we're glad that you asked us all the same. So the first question came in via our website, and you're welcome to send any questions to us this way. And the question is, I'd love to hear what steps you guys took to get your manuscripts good enough to submit, courses, assessments, paid editors, and what in hindsight you recommend most for want-to-be authors. So Catherine, I'm going to make you start
on
this one.
Cool. So the first thing I did after having written the novel from beginning to end in the space of about 2 months, having not edited any aspect of it, was I sent it out to some readers. I did this way too early in retrospect.
You were a baby writer actually, then.
And I've never done that again.
Wounded by the process.
No, I just felt it was a big impost and it was terrible. Like, so I think I'm at a point now with the second manuscript where I will do this soon-ish. But I think it's got to be reworked.
Yeah.
You know, that was a bit, what do you call it? A bit not long enough in the oven. I did 2 manuscript assessments. One, again, probably too early.
So hang on. So how did you do this?
So one I did quite early on, and I just applied through Writer's Vic, didn't even look at who the people were, which was fine. I think the main thing that I got out of that, I only needed limited feedback, I suppose, or I was only capable of dealing with limited feedback. So I got a lot of feedback, but it was key things that I was able to then focus on because I didn't have a community. I didn't have a writer's group. I wasn't studying at the time. So that was very helpful. I think you're able to absorb a certain amount of feedback at different points in time.
Yeah.
So I think the feedback that I needed at that first round was a lot simpler than, say, a manuscript assessment I got. Actually, Carney got it for me for Christmas about 3 years
Merry Christmas,
later,
darling.
Which is very sweet. And that was a much more detailed, structural, sort of really engaging with the content of the novel, which was a lot more fully formed at that stage. I went to an ASA, Australian Society of Authors, pitching day.
Yep.
I did that, spoke to a couple of different authors. Didn't get a lot of interest.
Right.
Don't erase
Aren't
it from my memory.
Sorry now with what they missed. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, hard copy was the major turning point for me.
And what did they tell you in hard copy about this kind of particular thing? How do you know when your manuscript is ready to send out?
They didn't really say. I guess for hard copy, what was interesting about it is the first round, they select 30 people and you have 2 weekends in Canberra. And then from the 30, you kind of work a chapter or a piece, send it back and they pick 10. So, I mean, and apparently not everybody applies for that final 10 and at that final 10 go on and meet publishers and agents and bits and pieces. So I guess that selection process was a good gate point. In some ways, it was them saying, we think this is the most
everyone's
ready
kind of
to
ready-ish.
Others.
Yeah.
If I'm really honest, I think that I got kind of to two points that sound maybe in conflict, but sort of weren't at the same time. One was that I couldn't do anything more with it. It was at a point that I was willing to go out on it. Like, if it got rejected,
yeah,
I'm done.
Yeah,
that's all I'm able
all
to do.
All of my life,
on
I'm
it.
Giving to this.
And the other was I'd kind of given up in some ways. Like, I am a personality that's prone to. I hate that I'm kind of person, but I am prone to obsession.
Yeah,
I get really, really. Like, I have a lot of discipline muscle and I can exercise it a lot to maybe to the detriment of other aspects of life. So I had become so obsessed with it that it was having an impact.
Yeah.
You know, so I sort of had to, I did have a moment where I was like, what is really important in life? So yes, writing is really important, but you need to have balance. You're not living in a cave.
Yes.
I sort of let it go. The fact that life was not about publication.
Yeah.
And I think that act of letting go in some ways made the process a lot easier.
I think that's so important. And I think to answer the question from my perspective, I think you can absolutely, something can be not ready to send out in that, you know, you haven't had anyone else read it or you haven't let it sit for a while. But on the other hand, you can sit and wait so long that you come up with excuse after excuse for it not to be ready, or you do manuscript assessment after manuscript after manuscript assessment, and you do just need to find the place in yourself where you are kind of in that sweet spot where you're ready to let it go. It's still frightening,
yeah,
and it's always going to be terrifying, and it's like, you know, taking a part of your body and saying, hello, would you have a look at this and do you like me? But you can't worry so much that you just hang on to it forever. You have to also be able to do exactly that. Let it go. Send it out. Give
it
to the person.
Yeah. I think you can fixate, you know, like it can become a, it's like turning a light switch on. You can just spend a lot of time doing nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for you, let's frame this in terms of second novel, because Skylarking was such a different experience.
It totally was. So second novel, for this one, I did get an early reader, so a friend who's a writer, very graciously, delightfully.
It's a generous act, isn't it?
Very generous. Did a read for me and gave me some great feedback, which I have kept printed out at each subsequent rewrite that I've done. I also did the mentorship, which we've talked about with Charlotte, and also Charlotte has done a manuscript assessment, a more formal one on the manuscript as well. So I suppose this time around I did it in a very different way than I did for Skylarking. You never get that first go again.
You seem like you were very at the helm of it in some ways this time. Like, it's, you're quite protective of it.
I've been very protective of it. And that's fear more than anything, I think. That's absolute fear, all the normal second book fears along with trying to do something really
different.
See,
I read it the other way. I read it as
confidence.
A confidence.
God, no.
Yeah.
No, it's absolute withering self-doubt.
I think you've got to tell yourself it's confidence.
Yes, true. It's confidence. but again, I don't think I got the timing right on sending it out, keeping it, hanging on to it. No, but I am, like you were, with the helpline, which wasn't the helpline at that stage. I've gone through the process. I've obsessed, I've adored, I've put every single part of me on the page, and if it doesn't work from here, I can let it go as well. You know, let it go with much teeth gnashing and weeping. But I think that's a part of the creative process as well. That means
and
something
also,
ready to put out
like,
there.
Do you really want to spend 10 years working on this? Like,
no,
you could have like 3 manuscripts.
Exactly.
Like,
also, because of course, I like to give myself ridiculous research opportunities for books. And so, I mean, that's why you've got to go for your next one, right?
It's motivating in
what
itself,
kind of crazy
it?
Thing am I going to do next time around? Anyway, this is why we can only answer 3 questions, because we talk so long. So our next question, this comes in and it's about launching books, really. So this came from a person who said, I feel a deep sense of sadness from those people I really admire, who maybe didn't turn up for the launch. did you have people who didn't turn up? How do you feel?
Well, my first response was, no, I don't really feel that way. I get how other people do. There's that saying in life, treat other people how you yourself would want to be treated. But I think you actually need to treat other people how they would want to be treated. So the reason I say that is because I think this anonymous person is probably someone who very much would go to important events in other people's lives.
Absolutely.
And I think that's where the disappointment comes in, because it feels like I would do that for someone else and they're not doing it for me. Whereas I think in my situation, I'm really loath to say this, but I've historically, something I'm working on, been more of a canceller.
Catherine which the is, canceller.
Yeah.
She only finds out now this is what we call her.
Which is...
That's not true.
Which is in no way a reflection of the person.
No.
It's a reflection of me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have no problem if someone cancels. Like if I...
Yeah.
You know. So that's sort of how it reads to me. Having said that, there was a person who didn't come to the launch, and I didn't even realise that she hadn't come until she said to me that she hadn't come and then gave this excuse that I was like, that is the worst excuse. Like, that is
and then you were
such,
cross.
Well, then I was like, "That's you're lying to me. Like, that's such a ridiculous excuse. So maybe I'm not as removed.
Well,
I've never spoken to her. She's dead to me. No, not really.
You know,
I think less of her, though.
I think there is something in the removal because I remember I looked at this question and I was like, nah, that didn't happen to me. And then I was like, yes, hang on a second, it did. There was someone who didn't come, who never spoke about it, who was like a kind of notable absence, like, you know, how are you going on the
Kate's
Monday?
Mom,
yeah,
she like, did notice.
Just didn't even kind of comment that I'd published a book. And in the moment when you have birthed a book and it's coming out in the world and you are the central light of your entire world and it's so friggin' important, those things hit really hard. Now, a little further down the track, like sometimes I wake up at night going, I cannot believe all those people with small babies.
That's how
and,
I felt.
You know, like they
driving
came.
Across town
they
at 6 p.m.
Yes, for my tiny little book.
So
like
nice.
I don't go to people's work things when they, you know, like in the end, it is my work thing, right? And it's a bit special because it's a book, but you know, I think about that too. I think about all the people I know who've got these incredible jobs who go about their day and come home and no one ever says what an incredible job you did.
The other thing I think is for people not attending is that two things. Sometimes people don't get books.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of it. And another thing is that sometimes people are jealous. Like that can be a hard thing, you know, that they don't want to be faced with your success.
And that's what you were saying before
just
too.
Again,
that's
not
their
you,
thing.
You know,
and you can't control that, right? So that's their thing. Some people are going to say, I'm not going to turn up to that event. And that's their
hard.
Thing. I think also in the writing community that, you know, we know of a clash coming up, a book launch clash. Like
I was
there
thinking
is a
we
lot
could
of,
divide ourselves
we should,
between you
conquer.
And I. We
that's
should
true.
One and
we
one.
Can just pretend that we're one. But I do think, you know, in Melbourne, there's like a book event on every night of the week. And the further you get into a writing community as well, the more people you know, the more events. And if you're juggling that with your other work and family and the rest of it, like sometimes you can't get to stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's also when you go, I'm part of a community. We've got each other's backs. You know, I know that I'm going to fall down in this one, but I'm going to go to another one. And knowing that, you know, that
that's
the community
true.
Is kind of there to support
that's
as well.
That's a very nice way.
So I don't know if that's helpful, anonymous person, but hopefully that
I do feel
gives
that
some food
pain,
for
though.
Thought. I feel the pain though. Okay.
Last question.
A lovely little DM on Twitter asking for a friend. Yeah, right. What is the correct etiquette with reviews? Do you reply thanks on social? Do you DM someone? Do you reply? And what about if you're tagged in a Goodreads review or review in a magazine? Oh, heavens.
What did you do?
Reviews. Well.
I wasn't even on Twitter when you were.
Yeah. Again, I don't think I did it right at the start.
Oh, you were in your little, I will engage with no one.
Yes. Weird. like people don't engage. Well, and maybe too, I hadn't been on Twitter long enough to go, oh,
yes, this is perfect.
Like, yeah, like writers talk to other writers and they talk to readers. Like, I don't know, I had some weird theory about the rules of the game. I don't know. Anyway, I didn't necessarily engage with everyone because I was like, oh my gosh, someone mentioned my book.
It's it is so a thrill, isn't
overwhelming
it?
And so thrilling. What do you even do? Maybe sometimes I like drafted a response and then I never did.
Oh, bless.
But now I say thank you.
Yes.
Maybe whack a little emoji in there.
I always say thank you. I'll often retweet it.
Yes.
There's no rhyme or reason to doing one or the other. I'm always deeply grateful and, very flattered that someone has taken the time to do that.
What about if someone gives you a bad review? Do you retweet that? Do you give them an emoji face? Or is that not happening
to
you?
I really don't want to say this.
Am I going to make you say it? You're in the cone
of
silence.
I don't really read them.
Catherine doesn't read her reviews.
Because.
That's okay.
I find it really hard to read them. And I think I will come back and read them in 6 months' time. It is not because I think my book is perfect as it is.
There's
it's
many
because
reasons.
I know the flaws of it. You know,
yes.
I know how I would fix
it
right now, this very day. And I even find, in general, reviews have been really lovely.
Yeah.
I even find the compliments, like I'm sensitive to it and I'm not sure how to engage with
it. Yeah, which is exactly what I think that this person.
So I just retweet them. They could be saying it's a terrible book.
Yeah.
And I am there saying, high five, thank you very much.
Well, you're thanking them for the mention. And I did a little research on this and there were some great articles about basically, you know, any press is good press. So, you know, if you get only glowing reviews, then people are going to be, oh, why is
this? It's suspicious.
Yeah, it looks kind of suspicious. So it's good to have ones that aren't so glowing. The big thing that came across in all of the stuff I read was don't engage.
Yes.
Don't engage with a shitty review. Like, don't bite back. Don't.
Is there a story of that on?
Oh, no,
that was a different story.
Oh,
someone
God.
Had written a book and then another person from their writer's group had
heard that.
Oh, gosh.
Do we know who that is?
Been quite critical of
that. Can't remember. But, yeah. So Goodreads, I would never go on Goodreads and respond to anyone on Goodreads on my positive or negative or any other way. And if you are one of the lovely people who've requested to be my friend on Goodreads after you've read my book, I also become your friend because Goodreads just, it's a world that I don't go into. I'm very grateful.
I'm
very grateful for the people who review the book because I understand it to be a reading community where people find out about the books that they want to read. So that's amazing.
Speaking of Goodreads, though, there is an event coming up.
There is.
Probably will be gone. But
there is. Where
it's a very good event.
I think
Bram Presso is
the brains behind this event, which is going to be at Buck Mulligan's, but it may have indeed already passed where a whole lot of writers have put their hands up to read out their one-star reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome therapy.
Yeah.
The few people that I mentioned to it to immediately went, oh my God, I'm there for this.
Yeah, it's a real sense of community in that.
Yeah, and group therapy with whiskey. But I think also if people tag you, I've seen this happen on Instagram and Twitter a few times where all writers have just gone, don't tag me. Like if you are a person who
is negative, that's
don't tag a writer with a negative review. Like, are you serious? That's just so uncool. I have had people, which has been really lovely because I have been Instagramming my reads this year just more so that I can actually see what I have read at the end of the year. And they're very much like, I'm taking pains to not really write reviews on there, but just a general little thing so the people who follow me can see.
And you've got hashtag what Kate read?
Oh my gosh, that is what my gorgeous Lorinda, I know you're listening to this, my gorgeous sister-in-law said, you need a hashtag for this. So it is what Kate read next. You can follow that hashtag.
I looked at it the other day.
And when you go to the library, as she does, and works out what to put on her reading list next. But I have from that, so I'll always tag the writer and the publisher because I know that that works for the book or it's a good thing to do. I have occasionally had gorgeous DMs back.
Oh, really?
From writers, which is really delightful. I don't expect that. I don't do it for that purpose.
Oh,
I do it just
maybe I should be DMing
generally as a thing. But I think I have very occasionally done this to people as well. Like if someone leaves a really beautiful review or says something delightful about your book, or I've had like gorgeous students who are studying the book in school do artwork and stuff inspired by skylarking, then I will send a personal message to them to say,
"It's lovely.
That's really delightful.
I should be doing that."
Well, it's just, but again, I didn't do it at the point that you were at because I was like scared of the whole who am I, who are you, what's the divide between writer-reader kind of thing.
Yeah. So you probably were like that at the start.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Maybe we all are.
Maybe we all are.
Become better with distance.
So, dear Anonymous, you can take that.
DM.
Take that into your...
That's my revised recommendation.
Revised recommendation.
I don't think anyone would be upset with a direct message.
I also do think that this is where your writing community comes in. So rather than you having to respond about the review on Saturday morning that comes out in all the papers, this is where your writing gang goes, "Oh my goodness, how amazing.
That's very good
You
advice.
Got reviewed in this paper," or, and then it's a little bit more reviewed. Then obviously, you have to respond at some point because your friend has posted it, and it can all be a little bit less.
Yeah.
Put your hand up, look at me.
Yeah. It's a balance.
So do it. Writers do it for other writers.
Just waiting for Pink to read.
Oh my goodness. Did you see that? Shout out to
Twist of Auschwitz.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Who I saw this on Twitter and Instagram, I think, because Angela Meyer posted about it that Pink is reading The Tattooist of Auschwitz, and it already had 34,000 likes when I saw it. So who knows what it's got now, but you know, Pink, if you want to read our books, we'll send you a copy. We look forward to answering more of your questions. Just send them to us and we'll do our best to give you our combined wisdom. In this episode, we have a special double interview with Khalid Wasame and Adut Wol Akek. They're both contributors to the New Black Ink anthology, Growing Up African in Australia. We talk about the anthology, the writing community, and what's next for both of them. We are so thrilled to welcome two guests today, writers Adut Wol Akek and Khalid Wasame, who are both contributors to the new anthology from Black Ink Books, Growing Up African in Australia. Adut is a South Sudanese-born Australian writer and poet who lives in Melbourne. She has a Bachelor of Science majoring in Environmental Management. In 2018, she was a highly commended recipient of the Wheeler Centre's Next Chapter Grant program for developing writers. Khalid Wasame is a writer, photographer and arts producer who lives in Melbourne. His essays and fiction have appeared in The Lifted Brow, Overland, The Big Issue, Cordite Poetry Review and Lit Hub. He's previously edited fiction for The Lifted Brow, worked as a creative producer at the Footscray Community Arts Centre and co-directed the National Young Writers Festival, and he's currently working on his first novel. Welcome, Adut and Khalid. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to start where we always start, which is to ask if you remember the first piece of writing you ever had published, whether it be at your primary school, online, wherever you had it. Adut, can I start with you?
Yeah, I actually remember like my first piece because it was during like my English class.
Yep.
I don't remember what we were reading. I think it's a book that had a character's name. Her name was Adeline.
Okay.
And like when I doze off, I like write. So I didn't want to learn. I'm like, I'm tired of these essays you're talking about. So I'm just going to mind my business. So in the back of the English book, I wrote like a whole poetry piece on this girl named Adeline. And then like the next week when we came back, my English teacher was like, "Oh, dude, I found your writing. It's incredible. I found your writing." I'm like, "Excuse me, what writing?" She's like, "In the back of the book. It's beautiful." And then she had it published for the school newspaper. And that was my first piece.
How old were you?
I have no idea. I was year 9, so maybe like 16.
And what did it feel like when you saw the words there? And when you realized that other people were reading them? Did you feel vulnerable or proud? Or
it came as a bit of a shock. I'm like, oh, well, this is awkward for everybody. This wasn't for everybody to read. I was just me mucking around. So I was shocked that it was taken seriously. I was like, oh, so you guys do this for fun? Okay.
And was that the beginning then of writing a whole lot more poetry?
No, I actually had like a huge gap in writing. Like as soon as that happened, then that's when like, get serious with VCE. You need to pick the subjects. Can't really make a career out of writing. You need a proper career. So I'm like, okay, cool. So you give up on writing a bit for a couple of years. And then I think 4 years back from now, or like 5 years back, I was part of, I'm still part of this group called Still Nomad, and they were like a collective arts group, like a young collective arts group of African diasporic black kids, basically. And they were like my first start, or like, I don't know how to explain it. They sort of like lifted me up, like, oh, come, you can write, we can do this. I'm a writer, I'm a singer, we can all do this, this is fun. And I was like, okay, I guess I could do this.
That's great. Yeah. That moment of, I suppose it's validation and being given permission to then kind of own your art.
Yeah.
Thank you. Khalid, what about your first piece? Do you remember it?
Yeah, it wasn't actually that long ago. I've been doing this whole writing thing for a while. I've known that I wanted to be a writer from a young age, but I was also always very embarrassed about my work and a bit shy about my work. And I was convinced that I'd have to have to attain a specific level of like quality or goodness or work on my craft for long enough that I could finally feel comfortable sharing it. And it wasn't until in 2014 I went to the West Writers Forum at the Footscray Community Arts Centre, and I sat in on a couple of panels, and I haven't been to a writers' festival before then. And so I was in the audience, and there was this panel with Omar Musa and Christos Soltis and a few other writers.
Nice.
And afterwards I was at the cafe, and I ran into someone who I knew from Brisbane, and she was also a writer, which I didn't know. I just thought she was a radio maker. And then she introduced me to Omar Musa, and we just had a short chat, and he just seemed like just a normal guy. And it just kind of shattered the illusion of writers being something that they're not. Because up until this point, I had just enrolled in creative writing degree. And I was also finishing up another degree at uni, and I sort of left that degree just as I was about to finish it to enroll in a creative writing degree. And I was finally starting to actually meet other people who are writers. Mm-hmm. And I think it was meeting somebody who came from a similar background as I did, where he's from an ethnic background. Mm-hmm. He's from Queanbeyan, which has got a lot of atmospheric similarities to Werribee. And also, I think something, and then a week later, I just submitted a piece to Overland, and it got published, and that was the first piece that I've had published.
Wow, that's great. I just read that because I wanted to ask you, there's a conversation in there that you have with your father, you describe that you have with your father when you're about 15 about the idea of becoming a writer. Can you just describe that or tell us about that?
Well, my dad's the only other reader in my family. And I initially accessed literature through him because it was, you know, I've got five siblings. They're all extreme extroverts. They're all loud personalities. They're accomplished in ways that I'm not, where they're into sports and they're good with their hands, and they seem to be, and I was just this quiet, shy, introvert kid, you know, and I think I got along with my dad because we've got the exact same personality.
Sure.
But my mum is loud and larger than life, and the life of every room that she walks into, and my siblings are all like that as well. And I think I initially got into that through I think my dad recognized that he had a kindred spirit, and he got me into reading through that. And he grew up in a period of time that was very tumultuous in Somalia's history, and he left home at a very young age, and he grew up in outside of Africa. He grew up in Moscow where he studied. And I think reading and writing for him he's not a writer, but he reads, and it was had a similar usefulness for him, in the sense that it was a refuge for him as well. And I think that is how I got into it to begin with.
Is he one of your first readers?
No, I think he doesn't have, I'll send him things sometimes, or he'll read some things sometimes, but he's got a very, I think I'd be embarrassed to show him a lot of my work a lot of the time. I'm very careful about what he gets to see.
Sure. Adut, who do you show your work to first?
Not a damn body.
That's the right answer.
Yeah, because I also like come from a very big family, like seven kids and a mom and a dad. So I think I'm the only one that's really into writing. Like I think my other sister is, but I'm the only one that's like out with my writing. So when it comes to my creative writing, nobody sees it.
Okay.
The end of story. Until I decide, you know what, I'm just going to throw it on the internet. Then it will be thrown on the internet and that'll be the end of that. But like when it comes to like essay writing, like for school wise, yeah, my sister helps me with that because I cannot.
That's great. Yeah. I liked in your bio for the Digital Writers Festival, mm-hmm. you described that you were, you described yourself as slowly coming into your craft.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like that's how you're progressing through it?
Yeah, definitely. Because I still find like, because with this whole writing thing, like you're not, it's not for the glamorous lifestyle. Like I, you know, make a living out of writing. That's how I pay my bills. Yeah. No, I have to get a full-time job on the side. So a lot of the time I would like spend all my energy working. So when I get home, I'm like, I'm tired. I don't want to write. And that's like part of the slow process of writing as well. Because when I do get that downtime, I'm like, oh, thank God, finally.
I wanted to ask you about that. Your background is in environmental management.
Yeah, management.
So what is that, where your full-time work has taken you at the moment?
Not really, actually, but I do work in a science department-y kind of thing.
Okay, great.
But I don't think it was because of my science degree that got me there.
So how does the creative writing fit into your life?
Like, it does not. It's just like a part of me that I don't know how to explain it, but it's like having two parts of you where like one part of you is for the survival, which is the working full time or whatnot. That's a necessity in this economy, where like the writing part of me is like the me when I don't need this hectic lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Khalid, what about you? You've been heavily involved in the art scene as a producer and a creator for many years. You said you're working on your first novel at the moment. How do you balance the work writing kind of life?
Well, originally I had normal jobs for a long time, and then I had, you know, like you do, you get a bit of a crisis where you're like, where am I going? What's happening with me? And I really thought about what I want my life to be like, and I realized that I don't really have anything that I really want to do that isn't related to the writing or the arts. And I originally went into the arts because I thought that that would be a way to be adjacent to my passion while still being able to pay rent. So I became volunteered a lot, and then I became a director of the National Young Writers Festival, and then started working at the Footscray Community Arts Centre after that. And over time, what ended up happening is that more and more of my life became about arts management as opposed to the arts. And I think this year I've taken a step back a little bit, where right now I don't do anything but write. And that is not tenable over time. That's not sustainable.
Yeah.
But I've been lucky enough to have the tremendous opportunity to be able to focus on it full time through a grant from the Australia Council over the past few months. And I will need to eventually go back to work. But for now, I'm living the dream, which is not so much of a dream as it is. Well, it's not so much of a dream because now I've got no excuse. And that comes with its own measure of fear and anxiety.
You know what you should do? I'm a terrible person at this, but like I'm an advocate for like taking yourself out of place to write. One of my friends, her name's Flora. She recently released her book, and she when she was explaining how like her writing process, when she's like she had to get out of Melbourne in order for her to actually write like the way she did. She's like, if I was still in Melbourne, I would not have written a chapter of this book. She flew to Vietnam for like 2 weeks and like came back with a book.
I completely understand
so
that.
You need to
leave. I was in last year, towards the end of last year, I spent 6 weeks in Nairobi. Nice. And I was there to visit family, and also we're relocating my grandfather there. So it was a lot of work around that. But also I did more writing there than I did in the previous 6 or 7 months. You know, when I talk about the work that I'm doing right now, the bulk of it is work that I did in the 6 week period where I actually did do work. And now most of my time is spent, you know, gardening and walking around the house and, you know, calling people and talking to them.
Angsting about
all
the process.
All important.
Tell me,
I love that you mentioned those two things. A, that opportunity that sometimes people can have or are afforded to commit to their writing for a certain period of time and to have that opportunity. Also with funding. What do you both think of the health of the kind of writing scene, the arts scene at the moment in Australia?
I personally think it's ass, but all right.
Yeah, yeah. I will quote that.
Like, for me personally, like, I'm having, like, I write all the time, but it's like the whole, like, affording to sit down and actually type it up and edit it and send it off. Like, I don't have energy for that because I'm spending all my energy elsewhere affording food to eat in order to think about these words I'm going to write down.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, the writing scene kind of needs help a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's, there are obviously like a lot of systemic and structural issues with the arts in Australia, as I'm sure you know. There are problems with the funding models that we use. There are problems with, you know, there are the book industry is slowly dying. There's so much going on, and there's so much that seems to be wrong. But the one thing that's always going to be vibrant and energetic and beautiful and lovely is just the amount of talent and the people in the scene and the people who are doing work, especially the young people who are coming up, who seem to have every young generation, the young people, they're the smarter they seem to get. And I don't know how to feel about that sometimes.
Terrified.
There's amazing people doing amazing work. That's not the issue, and that'll never be the issue.
That brings us to the exciting work that I wanted to discuss with you today. You've both been published in the anthology Growing Up African, which was recently published by Black Ink. It's edited by Maxine Beniba-Clark and co-editors Megan and Ahmed Youssef. Congratulations on your works in the piece and for talking to us about it. I was reading in Maxine's introduction that she said the collection was born out of a conversation on Twitter, as all good anthologies these days, but about the fact really that it was high time there was such a collection. How did you both become involved as contributors?
First of all, I'd like to mention that I know both these boys, Ahmed and Magan, because they we used to float around the same crowd, like within the Still Nomad crowd. So it came as a shock to me when they're like, oh, by the way, we're kind of editing a book with Maxine now. We're big people. Yeah. Thank you very much. So how I got into this book is that I entered my pieces into the Willow Center. That was also another tragic story, but like, we'll come back to it. So I entered my pieces into it and I didn't win, obviously, but I got the highly recommended category. Yes. And then one of the people from it was like, hi, dude, this person named Maxine is looking for your email address. Can I give it to them? I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then Maxine emailed me and she's like, hi, my name's Maxine. Rah, rah. I was one of the judges in the competition and I'm looking for a person named Adudwala Ketch. And me being, I am not professional. I was like, yes, this is me. Through an email, and I just hit send. And she's like, okay, well, we want you to be part of this incredible collection.
Love that. Rah, great story.
And I was like, ah, okay, here you go. And then that's how I got into the book.
Before I ask Khalid, go back.
Okay.
Tell me about the tragedy of the next chapter, Willow Center.
Okay. So the tragedy was, right, like I had like a couple months to prepare for it because my friend sent me the link for it. And I'm like, I'm going to apply for this. I'm going to write a short story because I have a bunch of short stories there and it'll be no problem.
Yeah.
So somehow I lingered around it to the point where it was like last minute. And I was like, all right, I could not write 5,000 words in a span of, you know, like 4 hours because it was already 12 and the end date was 5. And I'm like,
wow.
But however, I can write 10 poetry pieces in that space. And that's what I did.
Oh, that is incredible.
And I was like, what do I write about? What do I write about? And then I looked around my house. I'm like, my family abroad. And that was the title. I just wrote about my family and just sent it through.
That's an amazing achievement to get highly commended. Because there were so many entrants.
And I see how that is the tragedy, because if that's 4 hours of your work, my gosh.
I was so angry at myself. Like, I'm an idiot. I'm just
Well, it's opening
myself
up again. And,
definitely.
We will definitely link to that as well to make sure that people can see that they can apply for the next chapter fellowship. Definitely. It's an incredible opportunity. Okay, we'll come back to your piece in a minute because I really want to ask you more about it. Khalid, how did you become a contributor?
Well, I was told about it, that it was happening, I think, when Maxine was first putting the idea together with Ahmed and Maidan. I think she hit me up and we had a brief chat about it. And I've worked with Maxine before, and I had a relationship with her, and that was part professional, but part being like, Maxine's doing great things, and I'm
doing
just
the
there to, yeah. And she asked me to submit to her, which is incredible, and I was really happy to. I sent her an essay. I sent her this really long, really meandering, vague essay that was whittling at concerns that weren't. on theme. And she sent me an email back straight away saying, hey, this is a great essay and I think the essay is really good, but the collection is called Growing Up African in Australia. And I'm like, oh yeah, right, this essay is not about that, it's about other things. And then she we had a bit of back and forth about it for a while, and then she had the idea of excerpting a piece that I had previously published, and that's the piece that ended up being in the Growing Up African Australia collection. And the other essay that didn't get into the collection, that she rightfully pointed out wasn't the essay for the collection, that one ended up being a lot longer and became one of the essays that sort of formed the foundation of the core of the essay collection that I'm working on now.
Fantastic. So we will get to read it at some point.
Hopefully.
That's really interesting that you say that about that back and fro about what kind of piece you would put in, because I wanted to ask, I know, you know, the first in this collection, in the series that Black Ink did, Growing Up Asian in Australia, is widely studied in schools. Growing Up Aboriginal in Australia just won an ABR. I imagine it will be widely studied as well. About the kind of pressure that you might feel in contributing to this series about the type of representation that you're doing of yourself, if you feel like you're having to represent community, and about whether that felt like a pressure or an invitation.
I think my thoughts around this have changed a lot over the years. And I think the reason why the essay of mine that did end up being in this collection is one that I wrote in 2015. And I think lately, of the past year or two, my practice has changed enough that I'm no longer whittling at issues or the same sorts of concerns that would be the sorts of concerns that would be part of a larger narrative of my experience growing up in this country. I think I have tended to resist that narrativization of our lives recently. I'm not sure where the discomfort comes from, but I think the discomfort comes from the past couple of years and the political situation and the slide towards authoritarianism and closed-mindedness and cruelty that's been just a thread throughout our political and our lives are political, so it's throughout our lives. And I think I've become less and less interested in performing our lives for the consumption of others in order to convince them that we are deserving of dignity and acceptance. And that's what's changed now. But I'm not sure where that thread or thought will end up. I'm not sure where that'll be in the future.
I do it for the benefit of our listeners who couldn't see your hardcore agreeance with Khaled then.
I was agreeing so hard at everything he said. So the end. Okay. Everything he said, signed it. Full stop.
I didn't give you a heads up on this. I meant to ask you, Adut, if you would read from the start of your poem. Would that be okay?
Okay. My family abroad. My family abroad live on an island surrounded by water. My father once called it a prison on water, where everyone must pay to live, must pay to breathe, and must be reminded every day of how lucky they are. My family abroad live in luxury, the only kind of luxury you live when you've come from nothing. My family abroad left a country in war, left their homes, their loved ones, and took with them what they could carry, a handful of kids. My family abroad are still attached to my family at home, all attached by a phone call. My family abroad used their telephone privileges supplied by Centrelink of $10 a day to hear the crackling and static of our family at home. A successful day for my family abroad is when, after yelling and screaming, "Hello, hello, it is me. Can you hear me? We get, hello? Is that you? It is wonderful to hear from you again. Hello? Hello? We're doing fine. How is everyone? Everyone is sick. The old weep and creak with every century added to the bone. The young weep with every century added to... Everyone is weak. The government will pay me next week. I will send help. My family at home. My family abroad skip another overdue bill. Put it up there, right on top of the other overdue bills. I will pay it next week. Next Centrelink pay. Up on top of the water bill, up on top of the electricity bill, up on top of the housing bill. My family abroad are attached to the government like a child to a tea.
Thank you. Thank you for reading. It's such a pleasure to hear poetry read by the person who wrote it. Can you tell us the genesis of this piece? I know now the process of you writing it in that space, but where it came from and what you were wanting to explore and say.
I don't even know. Like, to me, it was easier to write about, like, my family. Like, when it comes to writing my poetry, I always find it easier to write about my family because, like, I can describe it like this. One of the pieces in the book is called My Telephone Dad. Mm. And it came because, like for a long period in our life, our dad was overseas. And that's, like, a huge part of a lot of our South Sudanese kids growing up here is, like, all of our fathers were always overseas, but they still, like, always called us, like, yes, I am your father. Mm. How is school? Okay, goodbye. And that was always the process of it. So
it's it.
I find it interesting what you said before about how you said you wrote it in 4 hours before. Yeah. But that's not actually the case, is it? Because the writing itself takes, you know, a certain amount of time. Yeah. But the genesis of the idea and the thinking about it and the turning around in your head, that's the actual process of writing. And I imagine that took a lifetime's worth of thinking about it.
It was just like eating at me, like, wow, dad really raised us over the phone. For 500 years, I'm like, we really live on the phone with our father. And then here we are, my telephone dad.
Mm. It's perfectly communicated in the poem as well, the way that you have written it, that sense of his distance and yet complete presence in the lives and trying to grapple around that power as well. Mm. Yeah. Khalid, tell us about your piece, Idle Thoughts, which begins when you are thrown by a question from a white friend who asks in response to the story that you're telling, did you at least go to the police? And you're kind of thrown and it goes into this.
Yeah, I think I'm very careful to talk about this piece because I've been talking about it a bit because of this collection, that's this anthology. But if I'm being completely honest, this piece was written a couple of years ago, and I'm always wary about how we talk about things that we've written in the past because I find that my perspective on it now is different from my perspective on it when I was writing. And when I talk about how, if I told you how I wrote that piece now, I'd be telling you how I wrote that piece from the perspective of me now, which might not necessarily be how I wrote that piece back then. So to access the version of me that I wrote that piece back then, I'd have to, I'm at a risk of dissembling a little bit, but, it was, I remember I had some, I was briefly obsessed. I went through the brief phase where I was obsessed with really long sentences. And I wrote this piece about this time where I used to work at the Big W in Werribee Plaza. And I was walking home one day and I was walking underneath the big car park. So Werribee Plaza is a lot different now than it was back then. Back then, the difference is really stark. Back then, it was a sort of a wasteland with a little bit of a shopping center attached, sitting on top of it. And it got pretty sketchy at 12 a.m. when I finished my late shift at the Big W. And I got jumped by Ripper Boys, and nothing really happened. I think they were just having some fun and they were a bit drunk. And I happened to be the person who they fixated on. And I was talking about something about that. I was talking about something else. And then I mentioned that a specific occasion to a friend of mine. And she asked if I ever went to the police. And that, I remember that question really surprised me because I don't think I think about the police in the same way as my friend does. And not to say that my experiences with the police are in any way equivalent to the experiences of people who live in other parts of the world, especially in America, where the police actually, you know, kill black kids, or in Australia where Indigenous people are really targeted by the police, or when we're dealing about how the Victoria Police deals with South Sudanese kids in Australia. Yes. Well, I'm, you know, I think, but I've had enough experiences with them that I don't really think of them as able or capable of helping me, despite the fact that how I would have. And it's also a bit, it's also a difficult question to think about even now, because right now I'm not in a position where I don't find myself often dealing with the police, because I have certain, like, I have certain privileges that I, as a person, you know, I've been to uni, I lead a reasonably middle class lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I'm not in a position where I'm being targeted by the police as explicitly or as often as other people in my community or other people that I know. But sorry, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it was about that. And it was, it's a very strident in your face essay, which reading it now, I'm like, I do sound a lot different on the page than I am in real life, because in reality, I am quite mild mannered. But it's a piece that comes from a place of anxiety and powerlessness and a no small amount of rage at injustices, and I wish I could have harnessed that feeling and sort of done something with it that was more substantial than an essay. But it's one of those situations that I feel, one of those moments where you feel something and it immediately transforms into writing so seamlessly that you don't really know where it came from afterwards. And I have trouble thinking about it now or talking about it even now.
Which is why the piece is so powerful. It strikes me too, the added challenge and work that you have to do in speaking about the pieces that you've contributed to the anthology in terms of the publication of it and the marketing of it, and even here what I'm asking you to do with it again today. How do you feel about that part of the publishing cycle, I suppose, the fact that then you, once the words are out there and published on the page, that it's part of potentially your responsibility as the writer or what the publisher's asking you to do to go out there and kind of spread the word as well. How has that been for you?
Well, I feel like my work or whatnot are not as, I feel like what Khalid was saying with his essays, like it was a bit of a, like a traumatic kind of event that he has to repeat and explain over and over again. But like with my pieces, they're not really anything like that. So like when people are like, oh, talk about it, I'm like, A, B, C, D, the end of story.
Okay.
It's not, yeah, I'm like, there's nothing changed, A, B, C, D. That's the end of it.
Khalid, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I want to provide a world of context to each time. Every time I talk about something, I want to provide so much context, because in my head, it feels like I need to provide context or I need to explain it. But the role of the writer isn't really to explain their work like that. I feel like we're used to having this ecosystem of discussion around the work and the artists being a part of that. But I struggle with that a lot of the time, because especially for, I can talk about the work that I do now, and I can talk about it because it's a lot of the work, a lot of the writing that I'm doing now is, you know, born out of a series of ideas and concerns and issues and questions that I have, that I think about a lot and I think about deeply. But there's also work that comes from a place that's a little bit more raw and a little bit more unformed. And talking about it doesn't help, because I change my mind about the work every single time I talk about it. I did an interview a few weeks ago on Triple R about this specific piece and this anthology. And in talking about it, I realized that I was forming a position for probably the first time since I wrote that piece, and I don't know how useful it is to have the writer talk about their work, but also they themselves not being able to really be really shed any light on the work itself. which is a danger. I don't know. It's a danger when we get writers to write about their work and we take their word when we assume that they have any special insight into their work.
That we are deeply unreliable. I want to ask you before we finish up, I want to ask you about what's next, where you want to see your writing going, what you hope for both the industry as a whole and also for yourselves as writers going forward. Adoit?
Crap. Well, so far I've been really trying for like the last couple of years to release a collection of at least some of my poetry.
Yeah.
Because there's no point of them sitting there in a stack of
they won't no shit
for no reason. Yeah. So I'm like, try to get that out of the way first and then see where I'll go from there.
Fantastic. Yeah. And Khalid, for you?
I've obviously got the novel that I'm working on. I've been meaning to collect the essays that I've been publishing over the past few years into a more substantial collection. And I'm currently in the midst of organizing a few essays and writing some new ones to fit into a larger collection. And the theme that seems to be emerging is memory and like the unreliability, which I've gone into a little bit here. It's a recurring topic. You get me talking long enough and I'll eventually end up talking about how I don't remember anything and how I don't know anything and how that's an anxiety for me. I'm also doing a bunch of other stuff outside of my writing and trying to figure out what the next steps are once these projects are finished or at least rested.
That's right. I did hear too on that Triple R interview that you are doing a furniture making course.
Yeah, I'm doing a furniture making course, which is really fun and exciting. And I was just in the workshop the other day, and it's pretty fun because it's not that far from the writing thing as well. Because yeah. I'm in the workshop and I'm in there for 8 hours, and I'm measuring things and cutting things. But that's all not work that requires me to.
Yeah.
Because with this course, I'll spend a week or so drafting and planning a piece, and then modeling it. Usually, I will do it either on the computer or I'll draw some plans on a large sheet of paper, but that's the thinking work that goes into it. From then on, it's just cutting and chiseling or
fitting
work together. And in that time, I just listen to podcasts, and
we highly recommend that activity.
Yeah. So yesterday I was in the workshop for 8 hours, and I just finished I listened to an entire season of a podcast series about Watergate.
Great.
And it was nice. And then I went home and I wasn't exhausted. I was exhausted physically, but I wasn't exhausted mentally. So I just was like, well, I could do some writing now. Whereas when I used to work in an office, I'd just be like, last thing I want to do when I get home is sit in front of a computer.
Yeah. What advice would you give other writers who are at the same point in their career as you are now? What have you kind of learned along the way or what would you recommend to them?
Well, I heard somewhere, I'm not sure where I saw this quote, but someone said, as a writer, there's always time for you to write, or something along the line. If you really want to write, there's always time for you to write. And I think, like, with me, like, I reflect back on, like, what I do for my entire day, and I'm like, I could have really squeezed in 20 minutes of writing if I really wanted to. So I think it's really important as a writer to, like, there's time for you to write.
Yeah.
There's always time, whether you're on the train from work, there's that good 15 minutes, you can have a few sentences down. Like, even if you're sitting on the toilet avoiding siblings, that's a really good place to write.
Excellent advice. Thank you, Adoit and Khalid.
I'm going to give some advice that I wish I gave when I did a guest lecture at RMIT a few months ago.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, one of the students, they're all like these beautiful undergraduate students who are so full of hope and potential. And one of them asked me a question that was really interesting because it was something that I haven't thought about as deeply as I feel like. I didn't give them an answer that I felt like I should have. They asked me about finding your voice or how do you find your voice. And at the time, I just said something really glib and meaningless, but the more I think about it, the more I realize, the more I came to the conclusion that I think that's the wrong question to ask. I think the question should be, what are you interested in? and what are your concerns as a writer, and what kind of, not what kind of writing do you want to be, but what kind of writer do you want to be, but more what kind of questions are important enough for you to dedicate a significant amount of time in your life towards answering, and everything else will come from that, I think.
That's a great answer.
Nice.
Before I let you go, can I ask you to recommend a debut novel? You mentioned one before and I didn't quite get the name of it. A debut book, or you said your friend had just released one.
Flora's book.
Yes.
But I have no idea what it's called.
That's okay. We can put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
But from any time, any place that we can recommend to our listeners.
I'm just trying to do the easiest thing and recommend the last debut book that I read, which is Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenyah's Friday Black. He's an American writer. Friday Black is a collection of short stories. It's amazing. It's interesting. It's inventive. It's viral and urgent and all these other adjectives. And it's, I think you can get it in Australia. It's published in Australia. I think it's out by Hachette, maybe.
Fantastic. Thank you. Yep. And
so this beautiful South Sudanese girl, a youngin even, released a book recently called Tomorrow's Dream. And it's her like poetic anthology, basically. And it's like her first work. And it's like self-published as well. And it's such an incredible, incredible book.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I think people should get hands on that.
Thank you. We will link to that too. Thank you both for coming in to us today and for talking to me and for sharing your stories.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
To find out more about Khalid and Adut and for links so you can purchase your very own copy of Growing Up African in Australia, head to the website, thefirsttimepodcast.com, where you can find the show notes for this episode. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter as well and tell us what you thought of the episode. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.